Did you hear about what happened at Market Basket yesterday? A man came in and told the young boy at the produce counter, "I want to buy half a head of lettuce." And the boy said, "Sir, we don't sell a half a head of lettuce." He said, "I want to buy a half a head of lettuce." "Sir, I am so sorry, but we can't do that." He said, "Boy, get your manager out here right now. I want to talk to him." So the young man walks to the back, and he didn't realize the man was following him. And he said to the manager, he said, "This idiot out here wanting to buy half a head of lettuce." Out of the corner of his eye, he saw the man behind him. He said, "And this kind gentleman is willing to buy the other half." About 2 hours later, the manager came out and said, "Son, I'm very impressed. You thought quickly on your feet." He said, "I need more like you. Where are you from?" He said, "I'm from Canada." He said, "Canada, why did you leave?" He said, "Well, you know, in Canada, there are only harlots and hockey players." And the manager said, "Well, my wife is from Canada." He said, "What team does she play for?" We just heard a story. Our life is made up of stories. And the incredibly important thing is we learn more from our stories and telling those stories and hearing the stories of others than almost any other methodology. I want to read a couple of things to you. They're brief, and then we want to talk for the rest of our session. Medical home is not something we practice only in a structured healthcare encounter. Medical home is a dynamic of one's life, which is active within every human interaction. No doubt medical home has a technology and a methodology, but no doubt it is not a technology or methodology. No doubt that medical home can be measured, but more certainly it will be observed. That's in one of the papers you received. However, to realize well and how alive storytelling is, you really just have to ride a bus or get on an airplane, and people will start talking to you and telling you their stories. And it's important to them that you listen. Why do you think Facebook has been the phenomenal thing it is? People love to tell their stories, and they really enjoy hearing other people's stories as well. But unfortunately, storytelling has fallen into disrepute. Radio and television and email and all these other technologies have really taken up the space, the time, bandwidth, if you will, of our lives, and we don't sit and talk to one another. As a child, I remember one of my most pleasant experiences was sitting with my grandmother, and women did quilting back then, and they would have a rack that came down from the ceiling, and they'd quilt, and when they got through, they'd raise it up to get it out of the way because the houses were not that large. And I and some of my cousins, we'd sit there and listen to those ladies talk, and we'd listen to them all day long. We'd really do some quilting. When I was 5 years old, I used to quilt with my grandmother. And they were wonderful experiences, but I learned who I was and where I was from and what was expected of me from those stories. Anecdotal medicine is not really highly praised because it really is based on our experience. We want evidence-based and random controlled studies to prove the quality and the validity of what we do. But sometimes we forget that our stories, while they are anecdotal, they are really the magic of our lives. In the case of medical home, while there is an objective standard against which to measure the essential functions of the medical home, it is the stories which are powerful. It's the stories which give breath. In this case, we refer to respiration and life. And depth, in this case, we refer to significance and validity to the healthcare experience. In 5 years ago, my medical practice, Southeast Texas Medical Associates, was given an award by the Gardner Award. It's an award for technology and analytics. And one of the responsibilities, we were a semifinalist, and I was so disappointed that we didn't win until I found out the group that won. We have 60,000 patients. They had 60 million clients. But we had to go and give a presentation in the meeting in San Francisco. And I went, one of my partners said, "I want to go too." So he and I went out there. And I gave my presentation, and the lady that was supposed to conduct the question and answers afterwards couldn't. She was sobbing, as were half the people in the room, because I told them stories. A technology conference about how well you use analytics how well you use a quantitation of care. And the thing that ripped their heart out was the stories. Through stories, we learn a lot about ourselves. We've participated in the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation's LEAP study, Learning from Exemplary Ambulatory Practices, conducted by the McCall Institute in Seattle, Washington. And we had one face-to-face that's gone on since 2011. And we had lots of other contact, but we went to Seattle, and I met a young man. You know what his job was? What he's paid to do for a medical practice? He was a storyteller. His job was to collect the stories and write them up and publish them. On our website, there's a section about medical home, several sections about medical home, and one of the sections is the stories and the ideals, because your stories tell you what you value. Even as a child, I'd walk into a home and I looked at three things. I looked at the pictures on the walls. I looked at the books on the shelves, if there were any, and I listened to the music. And you can tell everything you need to know about somebody, their values, because those tell you a story about them. And 8 years ago, I went to the hospital early one morning, and the nurses said, "You can't go in that room." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because the patient said he's going to kill the next doctor that walks in the room." Well, that got my attention. And I said, "Does he have a gun?" They said, "We don't think so." I said, "Good, let's go see him." Now, I have to tell you, I think the typical physician response would be, you know, because you're busy anyway, would be call the police and I won't see him. I was intrigued. First of all, I didn't really believe it, but because I don't have a death wish. I have been in dangerous situations and have acted aggressively to try to defuse them. So I walked in the room, and there laid this wimpish little guy. It looked like he was dangerous, maybe to a cockroach, but nothing else. And I said to him, "May I listen to your lungs?" He did this. He pulled his head back and he kind of stared at me like, "What?" I said, "May I listen to your lungs?" He said, "Yes." Here's the deal. He had no money, no job, no friends, no family, no hope, no value in his life, except one thing. He had a body that was still functioning. And the only thing he had control over was that body. And he was using it not to manipulate his environment, but to try to say, "Hey, I'm real. I'm a real person." And no one had ever asked his permission to touch him. I have five grandchildren that are redheads. So when a redhead walks in the room, I pay attention. If I walk back and approached you as we do with patients every day, you would say, "Hey, you're in my space. Get out of my face." Because we make certain presumptions, and we often don't ever ask a person's permission to touch them. I have a friend who always said, a license to practice medicine is a license to molest. What we do to patients every day would be molestation in any other setting. And if you don't know the person, you don't have an implied permission, you need to ask their permission. It totally disarmed him. I examined him, and then I determined to do something I don't really do well. I determined to listen to him as long as he wanted to talk. Because it was clear he desperately needed a sense of personal value. He started talking, and he talked for 30 minutes. I've been successfully married to the same woman for 52 years this August 7th. I don't think I've ever talked to her for 30 minutes continuously in my life. Now, unfortunately, I'm recording this, and she's going to listen to this, and she'll say, "That's right." Now, of course, after 52 years, we both think the same thing, so conversation is not really that critical. But I listened to him. The whole time I was listening to him with this ear over here, I was wondering, how can I give this person a sense of personal value? Because we want people to change, and they have no sense of personal worth. Why would they change? Their greatest hope is that they won't get shot in a drive-by shooting that day. You got up this morning, you expected something good to happen today. Little did know you're going to fall on evil times and come in here. But nonetheless, we each woke up with a positive attitude a hopeful attitude that something good was going to happen today. He hadn't had a day like that in forever. And I kept realizing that hope, the value, a sense of worth, is built on that you have control over something. I've already told you, you have control over nothing. And I said, what can I give him control over? There was one thing, me. All I could do is give him control over me if I wanted to instill in him a sense of personal worth. And so I gave him my cell phone number. And I said, you can call me anytime about anything, and I will be glad to help you. 10 days later, I heard in the community that this man was telling, said, you know, Dr. Holly's my best friend. I have his cell phone number. He had a sense of value, of worth. And out of that began to come a sense of virtue, that is, the power to do something, to initiate something and sustain it. And when you have value and virtue, you will inevitably develop trust. And he trusts me totally. And I would never betray that trust. Today, he's one of my dearest friends. He calls me pretty regularly, but never inappropriately. And so if you have value and virtue and trust, it's a natural result to have hope. And when you have hope, you're willing to change things in your life. IBM in 1994 was losing market share and losing profitability. And they hired a new CEO, and he hired some people called change agents. And they learned five things. We only talk about one of them. They learned that if you're going to make a change, it better make a difference. And that's the thing we have to do with patients. How do we help them understand that if they make this change that we're asking them to make, and we're encouraging them to, in the shared decision-making process that we go through with a patient-centered conversation, which concept I learned from Dr. Hanna, who's sitting right back there. Never understood it before I read his article. You should read it. I summarize it in one of the articles in this material you received, and get full total credit because it was original with him. This man began to have a sense of value, and he was willing to begin to make changes in his life. One of the first conversations I had with him on the cell phone, he called me and said, I've just been arrested. That was exciting. I've never been arrested, have you? Most of you have never been arrested. Most people I know have never been arrested. And he told me what it was about, and it sounded bogus. Over a period of time, a number of things happened, but he ended up pleading guilty to something he was not guilty of, I'm satisfied, so he didn't end up in jail. Because if he had gone to jail, it would have killed him. And in order to keep him out of jail, our practice through our foundation paid his probation fees. Now, if you don't think it was a step of gerrymandering, if you will, to determine that paying probation fees was a part of patient-centered medical home, that was a stretch for me. But we did. For 4 years. And it kept him out of prison, it kept him out of jail, and it literally saved his life. Now, that all happened because when I was told a man was going to kill the next doctor, I didn't believe it. Now, I'm not foolish. If a man's down there waving a gun, there's so many stories. And, you know, when you start learning to tell stories and recording your stories and putting them out on paper, by the way, my grandchildren have signs. Heard that, know that, they take when we go to dinner. So they, and my wife said, do you know that you told them that? I said, oh, I'm fully aware of it. But remember the Apostle Paul said, for me to repeat the same thing again is not a burden for you, but it's safe. You know, we repeat our stories not because we're demented or senile or just old men that kind of, you know, slobber in there and tell their stories, but because it's important for young people and others to hear our stories again and again. One of the things that you will read here is in 1962, I had my first experience with patient-centered medical home. I wasn't a doctor. I was a sophomore in college. I was 18 years old. I didn't have any money. I did not have a job. I met a young man who was a freshman, and he never opened his mouth. And I watched him, and I suddenly realized the reason he never opened his mouth, he had totally rotten teeth. And that he was ashamed. He was very quiet and reserved and stayed by himself because he had he had holes through his teeth. And you could see from one side of the tooth to the other. I went to a dentist and said, what would you charge to fix his teeth properly, which at that time meant a full mouth extraction and dentures? He said, I'd charge $300. That was, remember, 1962. I said, if I pay you next summer when I'll have a job, would you fix his teeth now? He said, yes. He fixed his teeth. It changed his life. But more than that, it changed my life, because at 18 years of age, I had watched my father and mother give when they didn't have money to give. I saw them, out of the meagerness of their income, share with others. And so I had learned that lesson well in my home. Last summer, my wife and I went on vacation. We drove from Beaumont to Dalhart, Texas in one day. That's 750 miles. I enjoyed driving. We checked in a hotel, and after we ate and got settled, I went back down because there was a young lady down there I wanted to speak to. And she was a redhead, by the way. And I went down, and she was by herself, and I said, would you do me a favor? And she said, sure. I said, would you smile? And she did, and confirmed what I observed. Her teeth were totally, completely rotten. I don't know how she was not in constant pain, because she had stubbles for teeth. She was 28 years old. And I said, have you ever wanted to have your teeth fixed? And she said, yes. I said, but you couldn't afford it, could you? And she said, no. I gave her my card, and I said, if you choose to contact me, I will see that you get your teeth fixed properly. Next day, I got an email from her. She said, is this one of those things that's too good to be true? I said, find out. I'm on vacation. When I get back home, you contact me. It took 8 months, but 3 weeks ago, her teeth were totally, she has totally beautiful teeth now, and it's changing her life. Now, neither of those were in a structured medical environment, but both were a perfect illustration of what I think patient-centered medical home is all about. It's really, my practice has had medical home accreditation since 2010, and our joint commission expires in 2020, so for 10 continuous years. We've been accredited by NCQA Tier 3 since 2010, and it goes through 2019 by URAC, AAHC, and the Joint Commission. So we've taken this very seriously. But more than that, we've learned that medical home is really a function and a power of your heart and your life, and that's what your stories are all about. And 7 years ago, actually 8 years ago, I encouraged my partners that we'd start a foundation, and we would put $500,000 a year of our money into the foundation so we could help take care of the patients that we have to take care of. No matter how much insurance a person has, many people are poor enough, they can't afford a copay. 12 years ago, I went to our HMO and said, I want to have a zero copay for our HMO patients. They said, if you do that, you'll be inundated with patients inappropriately accessing care. I said, I can deal with that. But I have patients that won't come in. They're honorable people, and they will not incur a debt that they cannot fulfill, and they don't even have $5 to pay that copay. They said, okay. In 12 years, how many patients have I had to chide for you coming into our practice unnecessarily? Zero. But we have statistics that shows that our fee-for-service Medicare patients and our HMO patients, these have to pay their 20% of usual customary costs, and these people have to pay zero. The care of these patients is better than these, because try as we want, we can't tell these people, don't worry about it, we'll work it out. We won't break the law, we're not going to just forgive the copay. We understand that but we'll find a way to take care of that. But they still won't do it as easily as these people will. And our diabetes care, hypertension care, lipid care, congestive heart failure is better in this group. We can prove that with analytics. We started the foundation, and the first patient referred to that foundation was a lady who had bad teeth. I've had a lifelong experience with bad teeth with patients, and this lady had been in the hospital 7 times in the previous 3 years. She was on 9 medications. Her health was deteriorating rapidly, and she had totally rotten teeth. I sent her to a I had never met her, and I sent her to a dentist, and he said it would cost $10,400 to fix her teeth properly. I said, okay, I want you to give a $4,000 contribution to our foundation, and I will give you $10,400 to fix her teeth. He said, okay. Fixed her teeth totally and perfectly and beautifully. Today, she's not been back in the hospital in 8 years, and she's on one medication, and she's as close to being pre-diabetic as a diabetic can be, because her health has improved so radically. Over one thing, dental care. And I know you believe that. And so I look at the 1962, the 2007, and the 2016. And I see this continuity of experience with people over healthcare needs. Some recognized in the setting of encounter, some recognized in a social encounter. But all the time, we're recognizing people's needs and wanting to fulfill those needs. Now, I do understand that everybody doesn't have $20,000 to fix someone's teeth. But you know what? That $20,000 for that lady last summer, how that changed my wife's and my life? Not at all. We didn't give up a meal. We didn't give up a whatever. Now, we don't spend a lot of money, so we have money to spend on others. But to me, that is what medical home really is. Those are the stories that empower you. The man that's mentioned in the conference material that Sue read the story, and all these stories are on our website. By the way, the title of the story about the gentleman that was threatening to kill the next doctor, the title is From Homicidal Threat to Reciprocal Caring. And last night, a group of people that I admire and respect very much had a dinner together, and we got telling stories. Dr. Han was there. And the interesting thing is, the most desperate situations of patients who were befriended by someone reaching out to them and investing in them and instilling in them a sense of personal value, which resulted in virtue and trust and ultimately hope, resulted in them beginning to care about us. Dr. Han, I'll tell his story, but he had a patient that he had befriended and given extra contact with him, and he was sick himself, and he starts getting these phone calls from this guy, and he finally answered him and said, could I call you later? He said, oh, I don't have any needs myself. I don't know how you are. I heard that you had canceled your clinic. And this guy was caring for the caregiver. The caregiver became the care receiver. And to me, that's what's going to happen in patient-centered medical home. And now the man who was would threaten to kill the doctor and who had nothing and was going to go to jail, he calls me regularly saying, are you okay? Or he texts me and says, are you okay? Is everything all right? Is anything I can do for you? Now that's when relationships really become reciprocal relationships, when there's mutual caring. And that's everybody at that table last night started telling stories about people they had befriended. Some of them were incredibly dramatic. I went to the hospital early one morning, as I always go to the hospital early. And the nurses on the fifth floor in Baptist Hospital said, you shouldn't go in that room. I said, why? He said, he is mean, hateful, bitter, and angry. I said, I love those kind of people. And I went in, and I'll tell you what, I did my song and dance. I jumped up and down. I did everything I could, and I couldn't break a smile, and I couldn't break his bad attitude. The next day, I discharged from the hospital. He was a patient of one of my partners. I discharged him, and I said, I want to see you in my office. When he came to my office, I discovered some things about him I didn't know in the hospital. I discovered that he was on 9 medicines but could only afford 4 of them. He couldn't afford the gas to go to diabetes education. He had diabetes for 10 years. He was losing his eyesight, couldn't afford to go to the eye doctor. He'd been our patient a very short period of time. He had lost his job and didn't know how to apply for disability. That day, the man, and he was still bitter, angry, hostile, and angry. That day, he left with our foundation paying for his medications. We negotiated a better price than he could get. We gave him a gas card and to be able to afford the gas to come to diabetes education. We waived the fees for diabetes education. Our care coordination department began working with him to help him apply for disability. And if you ever want to know something that's really insane, for all the money we give away to people, if you go on Social Security disability and you have serious health problems, you have to wait 2 years before Medicare kicks in. So for 2 years, we paid for his medications. It cost us $1,600 a quarter, and we paid for that. If we hadn't, he'd have died. Back to the second visit, he came. I made sure he had all his medications, everything was being done correctly. He came back 6 weeks later. He walked in, this time with a smile on his face. And he was transformed. His hemoglobin A1C was treated to gold. He had a positive attitude. He was happy because he now had the hope that after diabetes there was life and he could live. He became a very good friend and a longtime patient now. But about a year later, he came in. He was really sad, and I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "I'm afraid you're going to get tired of helping me." He said, "Will you ever stop helping me?" And I said, "Yes, we will." He said, "When?" I said, "The day after we go bankrupt, that when we have no money for anything, but as long as we've got money, as long as we've got resources, you'll be at the top of the list, as will everyone in your setting." Now, I wrote his story, and then I wrote a follow-up to his story, because 2 years ago, there was a national medical home conference in Philadelphia, Tennessee. I'm sorry, Philadelphia.
Pennsylvania,
thank you. And both these men went with us, one of them with his wife and other patients, and they were on the panel, and they made presentations, and it was absolutely dramatic to hear them begin to talk about how their lives had changed because of a thing called patient-centered medical home. And we had learned so much by telling their stories. And we didn't violate HIPAA. I assure you that everything I'm trying to tell you now, even if you could identify the patient, they're happy for them to know. Stories are powerful. Stories can tell us where we did something wrong. On October the 10th, 2010, I saw a young lady. And you have to understand, I'm a brilliant diagnostician. You're okay to smile. This young lady's father had diabetes, her mother had diabetes, her sister had diabetes, and her brother had diabetes. Being the genius that I am, I thought, you know what? She may have diabetes. And so I checked her, and she did. And I put together a plan of care and a treatment plan that was absolutely state-of-the-art. The next morning at 7 a.m., I called her, and we spent a half hour on the phone. I went over it with her. And as I hung up, I had this sneaking suspicion. She was very pleasant, that she really wasn't buying it. So I sent a telephone follow-up message, which we can delay 1 day, 3 days, 5 days, to our care coordination department. I told her, "I want you to contact her in 72 hours. And they did. And she said, "I appreciated the visit. I enjoyed it. I appreciated the follow-up call. But I'm not going to go to diabetes education. I'm not going to take the medication. I'm not. There is a thing we talk about, the baton. Do you know what 8,760 is? I know there's one of you at least knows. 8,760 is the number of hours in a year. If a patient is receiving a great deal of care, even in the patient-centered medical home, they'll be in a healthcare provider's presence 60 hours. Now that's 5 hours a month. That's an hour a week. I don't know many patients getting that kind of face-to-face contact, but even if they were getting that much, there's still 8,700 hours a year. Guess who's in charge of their care? They are. And if they're not activated, if they don't know what they need to do, if they're not engaged, actively involved, if they've not participated in shared decision-making, if they don't have a plan of care and treatment plan they understand, then guess what? The reason we fail is because the transitions of care, we talk about transitions of care being from the hospital to the ambulatory setting, or from the hospital to the rehab, or from the hospital to the nursing home. But you know where the most common transition of care is? From the office to the home, when the patient leaves our home. And if they don't have a plan of care and treatment plan, and we call that the baton. I love athletics, particularly track and field. And there was a time, you know, the American Olympic team has routinely won the 400-meter relay race always. But that is not a race so much of speed, though it is, but it's a coordination, the ability to transfer that baton successfully within a box of time to the person that you're going to, is going to take the baton around. And for two Olympics in a row, we lost it. You know why? We lost the 400 meter because the American team couldn't pass the baton. They either dropped it or they didn't pass it in the box and they were disqualified. Now, here's the deal. If we're not passing the baton, and what is the baton in healthcare? It's a plan of care and treatment plan that is grasped, taken hold of by the patient, both intellectually, understanding it mentally, but also taken hold of it physically and making it their own so they can practice what that plan of care and treatment plan discusses. In our clinic, every public area has a framed copy of the baton and its explanation, and every examination room has a poster copy because we want everybody to understand that that is a critical issue of making that transition of care from the doctor's office or the nurse practitioner's office or the PA's office to the home. It's critical. This young lady did not drop her baton. She did not misplace it. She took it and flung it as far away from you as you can. I had written about her and in fact, when I wrote, I didn't even identify her gender. So there's no way anybody could possibly know who she is. About 5 years ago, I was speaking. I'm sorry, 5 years after, it was 2015, I was speaking at a national meeting, and I wanted to tell her story. And so I looked up her record just to make sure that I was telling it precisely correctly. I opened up her chart. I saw it, and it was like a bolt of lightning. It struck me, and I was almost in tears. Because right there in the middle of that chart said, I want to lose weight. I had totally ignored that. I knew she had diabetes from her history that I took, and I focused on that, and I ran with it. And the reason she refused to do everything that I asked her to do, I refused to do everything she asked me to do. It was not a failure of her adherence of the worst word we use is compliance, but she wasn't adherent. It was that I had failed. And I learned more from that failure than almost anything else about patient-centered medical home. I have made desperate attempts to contact her. She's fallen off the face of the earth. Nobody can find her, doesn't know where she is. I wanted so desperately to find her for one reason, to apologize to her, because it was my failure. How many patients do you think I see every day now that I don't ask them, why are you here? What do you want? What is your goal? And then follow that goal. No matter how far away from what their real need is, I meet their need as they perceive it and then move them to where they need to go. It's if we tell our stories, and I had written the story, and it's on our website. And then I learned a lesson because I went back to review it. And it was really emotionally devastating. I was taken aback. Our stories can make a huge difference as we share them with others. Sometimes we're hesitant to share our stories because we're afraid somebody will laugh at us. Remember, there are no wrong answers. There are only no stupid answers. There are just stupid questions. My first day in medical school, where Dr. Ann teaches, I was a history and philosophy major. I had a master's degree in history and had the bare minimum. I finished the last science course a week before I started medical school. So I was not a scientist. And we were had the professor had these slides up on the wall, on the screen, and there were dark, round things, and there were things that were kind of washed out, and they were kind of pinkish. I had no earthly idea what they were. And I figured, you know what? I'd rather not sit here stupid. So I raised my hand. I said, what are those? And the class laughed. He said, well, those are the red blood cells that have been washed out. I learned. After class, six people came and said, thank you. I didn't know either. So, you know, I think as we are willing to transparently share our stories, even those where we made mistakes, it helps others be willing to learn from their mistakes as well, because ultimately that's we're all are going to have to face the reality that we're not perfect. It is impossible for us to live without mistakes. But the question is, are we going to learn from our mistakes? I would love for you to take a few moments and tell us one of your stories that changed your life or where you changed somebody else's life. Because the practice of storytelling is really, really important. To remember your stories, to write them down, to review them, to learn from them. Because that's where the power and the magic of patient-centered medical home is going to come from. Oh, we can do data analytics. We have since 2009 publicly reported on over 300 quality metrics by providing our name on our website. I don't know anybody doing that. You can't be more analytical than that. We took the IBM business analytics software and refashioned it for healthcare. We can tell you why patients are admitted to the hospital, why they're readmitted, why we can tell you we've eliminated ethnic disparities in the care of patients with diabetes and hypertension, but not with dyslipidemia. We have the statistical analysis to show that. But ultimately, it's the caring and the compassion and the passion for people that really makes it a medical home. All the rest is window dressing. Do you have a story you'd like to tell, Ligert, and share? It's a good discipline. I know it's scary, but this is a small group.
I have one, just to get things warm up here. So I was taking care of this patient who was here in San Antonio. He was big, he had lots of tattoos. He at one point was an IV drug user, but he was no longer doing that. And over the course of about 5 years, I took care of him. And I took care of his diabetes, and I was seeing him pretty often. And one day he came to the office, and he was all yellow. So we admitted him for the hospital, and it turns out that he had a mass in his pancreas. And we arranged for his surgery, and we were going to explore. And they opened him up, and they closed him right up, because he was disseminated. So we connected him to hospice, and he was in hospice. And then one day he walks in with his brother and his sister-in-law, who were the people caring for him. And he walks into my office, and I said, "What are you doing here? You're in hospice." "Oh no, I wanted to come and see you because I have clots in my legs, and I want you to do something." And I said, "Just go home. I'll come and see you later today. We'll talk about it when we get there." So after clinic, I had a medical student with me, and the two of us went to his house. When we got there, there were several of his sisters and brothers sitting in the living room. There were a couple of nieces and nephews, and he was in his bedroom. So I said, "I'm just going to go say hello to your brother." So he was sitting on his bed, and I said, "Is it okay if I sit next to you?" And he said, "Sure." And I put my arm around him, and I said, you know that you're dying, don't you? And he said, yes. And then there was a crucifix in the room, and I happened to be Catholic. And I said, you know, this is a good time for you to put your life in order, make amends with your friends and family, really spiritually connect. And he said, okay. And then I said, is it okay if I go and talk to your family? Because I love to talk to them. And he said, sure. And so I went over to the living room and I sat there and I said, you know, I have had the privilege of being your brother's doctor. And I sort of tear up. And he said, I'm going to miss him a lot. And I was just beginning the conversation. And then all of a sudden he comes over and sits in the living room and said, Dr. Hines said that I should come over and talk to you. And I'm sitting there, okay. And I said, I just want you to know, and this is to his brothers and sisters, that I pushed you away because I didn't want you to be having trouble with the police while I was dealing with when I was in jail. And I just love you the whole time. And they said, oh, we love you the whole time. Of course we know that, and we love you dearly, and we're here. And you know what? You're going to a good place. Mom and Dad are there. They're waiting for you. You're going to be in good shape. And then one of the sisters says, you know, it's not so bad. I had an episode when I saw the bright light, and it's not so bad. It'll be fine. And the conversation turned really into a celebration. And I said, you know, this is a party. We should get some food. But at that point, it was late. I left. A few weeks later, he died. And I went to his funeral and to his mass. And it turns out that he was, at one point, an altar boy in that particular church. And he has written, where they pass around, a beautiful poem that he has written about life. And I had no idea that he was a poet, and he wrote such beautiful things. So we went to the cemetery, and I just wanted to say hello to the family. And he said, Dr. Ryan, I'm so glad you came. But you know what? After you left, we did get food. We had a party. And, you know, for me, that's his gift. This day it shook up a little bit when I think about it. But it's such an affirmation of life. And the medical student that came with me recognized the humanity of this person who externally is often rejected and marginalized, but it was affirmed. And it's such a great gift. So I have a friend who's writing a book on narratives, and I eventually want to write it up. And I want to highlight his poem because it's beautiful. I wish I had it here because I would read it to you. But it's really about life. And in some ways, he wrote it way before he was sick, but it's really about touching each other through God's finger and something along those lines. And it's just a beautiful piece. So those moments happen, and they are very powerful. And you mentioned the other gentleman who I call my undercover angel, because, you know, here's a man who has metastatic prostate cancer, and, you know, he's doing okay, but he has this wonderful attitude and has all these other comorbidities. But he's the one who called me right after I'm just coming back to work, and I said, can I call you back? He said, oh, this is not about me. This is about you. My wife and I are praying for you, and we're hoping that you're okay. And it's that reciprocal caring. And I felt the same reciprocal caring from that family as I attended and connected with them. So that's one of the stories that, you know, it's that affirmation of the, you know, there's a philosopher in Kentucky whose name I'm blocking right now, but he talks about it all turns to affection. And it's just the notion that it is really about loving and how you express that in a way that is offered. I mean, I'm going to mention it in my talk, but, you know, the medical director of the advanced primary care clinic that we have has a clarity about his mission. He said, this is about alleviating suffering. So the question is, is that new program that we're going to do, are we going to be able to do it different? And if we're not, then we don't need to do it. So I think having clarity and affirmation is great, but I think we get a lot also from our patients in that context.
The power of stories is can never be discounted. Mario Bassanio is the past president of the Institute of Healthcare Improvement in IHI, and they're the people that brought us the triple aim in Boston. And she told me the story about her brother, who was 26 years old and had terminal cancer. He was receiving the best treatment you can get in Boston, which is a lot of care. You know, there are 200,000 or 300,000 students in Boston city limits, and there are all kinds of hospitals and, you know, world-class healthcare. And she said the oncologist was doing everything possible to be done. And one day she walked in and she said, "What do you want?" And he looked at the oncologist and said, "I want to go home." Every time I think about this, like you, Carlos, you tear up, because the oncologist picked him up after disconnecting all the wires and all the tubes, carried him to his sister's car, put him in the car, and she said the next 4 weeks were magical. They were wonderful and powerful in our lives, and he died. But he said, "I want to go home." Some years ago, I had a patient that needed a blood transfusion, and I knew the answer to that because he was Jehovah's Witness, and I told him, as I should as a physician, this is why you need a blood transfusion. And he said, "Well, you know, I'm Jehovah's Witness." I said, "I understand." And he starts to explain to me why he won't take a blood transfusion. And I said, "Now, I'm willing to listen to you if you want to tell me this. But I respect your right to not take a blood transfusion. You're legally, you have the right, you are of sound mind, and you have the right to refuse any kind of health care. But if you insist on explaining to me why you won't take a blood transfusion, I'm going to insist on at least equal time to tell you why I don't agree with you. But I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to tell you, oh yes, I think that's fine. I have to respect your autonomy and your willingness." And if there's anything in the power of stories, is it helps us understand some of these technical concepts about healthcare, such as personal autonomy. Patients want to maintain independence, and they want to maintain their autonomy. And as long as we can help them do that, we're doing them more good than all the medications in the world. Somebody else had a story they want to tell us. It gets easier the second time, but write them down. Tell them to your family. Tell them to your kids. You know what your children and grandchildren want to hear more than anything else? Stories about you. I have a friend who was on a bus in New York City. A lady sat down next to him, and he said, within 2 minutes, she was telling me the most intimate details of her life. She said, "I had to get off the bus, and I walked to the front of the bus, and she was shouting in the earshot of everybody, not angrily, but she wanted to finish her story." People will tell you their story if we're just willing to listen. And that's an art that we need to relearn, is how to listen. And I understand that we have time constraints, but we can use technology to decrease the time pressures. There's lots of things technology can do. One of the things we've done at Sentinel is that we've designed the automated team. Everybody wants to have a team. We have an automated team as well as another team. But when the patient makes an appointment, the computer goes in by itself and analyzes that patient's record against national standards of care, against screening and preventive care, and all those things that we routinely do. When the patient comes in, a chart is opened, three things happen. A note is prepared for the nurse, a note is prepared for the provider, and a note is prepared for the patient, which is much more robust. And it tells the patient everything that's been ordered, scheduled, or planned. And it gives them a paragraph about each thing. You're going to have a hemoglobin A1C. This is what it means. This is what your last one was. And those things are automatically done. We call it the shared decision-making and patient engagement document. We give that to the patient. We have a laser printer in every exam room. So we use technology to its maximum. But what it does is it decreases the providers, the primary care providers' needs about 30%. We don't ask them to see 30% more patients. We ask them to spend 30% more time talking to the patient. And, you know, you can create stories. By that, I don't mean you make them up, but you give yourself the opportunity because you're looking for opportunities to interact with people and to listen to them and care about them. Do you have any questions? I know this has been one of those ooey-gooey kinds of things, but it's that important, I believe. Yes, sir.
I have a question. I think, you know, your leadership at your organization is sort of well-known. I think sometimes we struggle to develop a culture around stories and how to allow everyone from the front desk to our physician leaders to develop a space where these types of things can be talked in a way that helps our patients. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your organization and how your
great question. We've done several PI CME programs, performance improvement CME programs, and we did one with our entire staff, all our nursing staff, front office staff. And I will never forget when it came time that somebody needed to tell the story about something, I called on my nurse and I said, "Would you go tell a story?" Well, she was more timid than everybody in this room, and she almost fainted walking in the front of the room, but she began to tell the story. And it was so powerful because she was telling it. Now, understand, I call her a nurse, but she has no formal training. All her training is on the job, but I would match her with most. She doesn't have a degree, and so she doesn't have a license. But so we don't do things that break the law. But she's really a bright person. You know, it's amazing to me how many people that work in medical offices ought to be doctors, and how many ought to be RNs, and how many. But the events of their life just didn't allow those things to happen. But we can enable them and empower them to be the best they can be. Totally. It's constant. But that's one of the things we do. We ask them, we invite them to verbalize what they think and what they believe. And they have great ideas. And that's what a team, every member of the team's got to be able to voice what they think and have that not challenged. You know, cautions are a unique form of human interaction, and they can never be discredited. They can only be responded to. And when somebody tells you something that they're anxious about, listen to them, because they may just have an insight that you are never going to have, and if you talk them out of it, you may miss a thing. But we have a culture where we meet together and we have people. Now, I have to tell you, there's one thing about medical home that aggravates me to no end, and it's this huddle stuff. And if it works for somebody else, but I'd say we have electronic huddles. But but what they're really talking about is talking to each other, and we talk to each other constantly. We communicate with one another constantly, with secure texting, with email that's between iPhone and iPhone, so that it's secure and it's HIPAA compliant, and also talking. Oh, thank you. Okay, but. I think that the culture has to be set by people that respect each other. I learned more medicine from a LVN in a little town outside of Waco, Texas, where I worked 7 days a week, 24 hours a day for a month from the time I graduated from medical school to I started my internship. You could do that back then. And that lady, I'd, in the middle of the night, I'd be doing something in the ER, and she said, "You know, I've noticed that they've done that this way." And every time now, I'd say, how do they? And I'm telling you what, I learned how to practice medicine from her. She didn't know the Krebs cycle, and she couldn't derive the Henderson-Hasselbalch equation, and I could. I knew biochemistry, and I knew physiology, and I knew all the technology of healthcare, but she knew how to do practice. I remember the first time I saw this big sebaceous cyst, I thought, "My goodness, this guy got terminal cancer." You know, that's how, you know, because our education didn't prepare us to practice medicine. It prepared us to learn to practice medicine. But I learned to admire and respect every member of the healthcare team. Those are unlicensed, they're LVNs, the RNs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners. One of our nurse practitioners told me once, she said, Dr. Holly, you're getting good enough. You're almost good enough to be a nurse practitioner. Now, most doctors would be offended. I was not, because I understood what she was saying. When I wanted to know what a plan of care and treatment plan was, you know where I had to go? The nursing literature. There's nothing in the medical literature. I didn't have a lecture in medical school about a plan of care. It was take two pills and call me in a week. That was a plan of care and a treatment plan. I wrote a paper about why that's on seven different levels. That's an inadequate plan of care and treatment plan. So I think it respecting one another, empowering one another, and inviting one another to be involved in a non-judgmental and non-confrontational and a non-argumentative fashion. And people understand when you really want their opinion. It's really fun if you like people. Healthcare and primary healthcare is, to me, we're the ones that can change the future of healthcare. I knew when the HHS secretary was nominated, his biggest flaw was what? He's an orthopedist. They have no concept, no understanding of process analysis. They have no concept of how to improve the quality. They know two things. How much am I going to be paid, and when's the check going to arrive? I'm sorry. That's what orthopedists are all about. And they're not bad people. It's just that they chose to be orthopedists because they like to break things, and they like to twist things, but they don't like to talk about things. And when he nominated him, I just almost had a heart attack. He's not a bad man. He just doesn't understand. I paid a presidential candidate $14,000. That's the maximum you can give. You know why I did it? I wanted to sit down with him an hour and explain the health care to him. I did. Cost me $14,000 to do it. And the next day he got up and said the same stupid things he'd been saying ever since. But that's off subject. You know, you're very kind to listen to my stories. I would love to listen to your stories. I'd love to read your stories. But most of all, I'd like to see you all become storytellers, because that's where you're going to find the real genius, the generative, the creative energy of what we do. Transformation is going to come from storytelling. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.